50 years ago this month, a book came out that awakened the nation to a number of environmental issues. The message of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring continues to resonate today. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Silent Spring closed the circle. Is Alaska where the circle is being closed today? Our phone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call of 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. What is today's version of Silent Spring? The question on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Every day, over 4,000 infants and toddlers go to sleep in child care programs across Alaska in unsafe cribs. The Alaska Community Foundation is partnering with THREAD to replace unsafe cribs in licensed child care programs across Alaska with new safe cribs. To help, donate today, and the Alaska Community Foundation will provide a one-to-one match of your donation. To donate, visit alaskacf.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
It really makes me feel old when I have to explain to a young person what Silent Spring was and who Rachel Carson was. Sometimes they'll know one, sometimes they'll know the other, but they don't really know what a huge change it made in the American culture. This one book by this one woman of a scientific bent who started out studying tide pools, really, did some nice nature writing, and then got caught up on this issue of toxic chemicals persisting through the food chain, and wrote a book about it. She knew she had cancer when the book came out. She died of cancer within 2 years of the book being published in 1962. And the legacy continues. I don't know. I mean, our whole environmental history of the past 50 years would be different in the United States had it not been for this book. And it's hard to say exactly how it would have rolled out, but it would have rolled out differently. The Endangered Species Act, every piece of environmental legislation, with the possible exception of some of the land conservation ones, stem from impulses that you can trace back to the book Silent Spring by Rachel Carson. So I thought, well, it's 50 years and time to revisit this and maybe give a little thought to why this book was so successful and what today. First off, there's a message in the book that probably is still going on, and we'll get into that. And then there's also the question is, what is the, if you were to try and do this today, what would it consist of, and would it involve Alaska? Because I have a feeling it would. I have a feeling in a lot of ways, Alaska is now a bellwether, is now a sentinel, is now a place where the circle is being closed, and this closing of the circle that I really want to talk about. I have a great panel, and I'm hoping that you will enjoy speaking with them. 1-800-478-8255. 478-TALK, a local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. The question really is, what is today's Silent Spring? And I think we'll start with welcoming back Carl Safina of the Blue Ocean Institute and author of The View from Lazy Point by telephone from Long Island. Carl, welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Glad you could be back on today.
Thanks a lot. I wish I was in Alaska, actually.
I know you have an interest in Alaska. Well, I wanted to ask you if you felt that you might be reaching towards the same place in your book, The View from Lazy Point, which traces basically a year in your shack out there in Long Island, very close to the point, and your travels in that year, mostly to other parts of the world and looking at various particularly climate warming issues, if you felt that you might be reaching in the same direction that Rachel Carson was reaching in when she was writing Silent Spring.
Well, Rachel Carson is, just a gigantic presence still, and I think we all stand on her shoulders and some of us stand in her shadow. What she was trying to do with Silent Spring, I think, was a bit different. It was at a different time. It was a different subject. She was trying to awaken the world to a whole new kind of thing that people were doing, because I don't think it ever occurred to anyone that humans could create something that would act very differently in the world than they expected it would act. It was kind of like a, not even a genie out of a bottle, because people would know what would happen if the genie got out of the bottle. But it was a new thing. It was that we would create a product, and then that product would do all kinds of things that were unanticipated. That was a new thing. What I tried to reach for with my book, Lazy Point, is a different kind of a thing. It's a big synthesis of our relationship with the natural world and how nature and human dignity now, I think, depend on each other. So I don't think so, but with my work in general, I would say that in very explicit ways, I think of what Rachel Carson accomplished as the kind of thing I would like to accomplish, which is to create a new understanding that people had never before considered. I think that was her, in a sense, that was her enormous contribution, was to wake us up to turn our attention into the path of the oncoming truth, that we were doing things that were out of our control and unanticipated.
I first got to know Rachel Carson's work because my mom was a big fan of the sea around us. You know, we lived inland in the mountains in Pennsylvania in the Allegheny Plateau, but she loved the idea of the ocean, and particularly Rachel Carson's book, which basically introduced her to a lot of things about the life systems out there in the tide pools and the ocean, and got her all excited, and she wanted me to read it, and I read it, and I enjoyed it. But, you know, when Silent Spring came out a few years later, I thought, this woman's gone off the deep end. she's gotten all whiny now for some reason. You know, it took me a while. You know, I'm saying this frankly, you know, and admitting to this. It took me a while to come around to realizing what she'd really accomplished with this book. And I think maybe the key to the way that it caught on with people, first off, it did sell very well. Second off, I think there you have a point there, Carl, in that it was the shock of the new or something that people hadn't thought before that really sank in. But I think there was also a sense of connectedness. And, my God, we're killing off the bald eagles. There was
The bald eagles and so many other things. I mean, the Silent Spring was a reference to the idea that there would be a time when no birds sang. And that's actually one of the titles of the opening, maybe the second chapter, or I can't remember exactly, but and no birds sang is part of what she was saying. You know, like there may be a time when all of the birds are so poisoned that they are simply gone. And I've never heard anybody really say that they thought that she was whiny. I've heard other people say that they thought that she was wrong. I remember a time, you know, in Alaska, it may seem totally impossible to people that all the birds would die, but I lived in the suburbs outside of New York City, and I remember walking home to school seeing birds dying. With guys were spraying somebody's trees. There were moths and caterpillars falling out of the trees. There were birds eating them, and those birds were in convulsions before they got across the street. So when I read that book, it seemed like a very, very steady hand on the tiller. And, you know, Rachel Carson did not want to write that book. She's a person for whom greatness was thrust upon her. If anybody ever fit that description, she epitomized it. She had three best-selling books. She loved nature. She was just a nature writer. But her nature books sold extremely well. They were all bestsellers. And she tried hard not to write that book and to just get somebody else to do the job. But no one else was really in the same kind of unique position. She was a known source, a trusted source. She understood how to use the material, and she understood the material. And even in hindsight, she was right. And she was also a person who explicitly said, I think chemicals have their place. She was not an extremist in any way, but she pointed out that they were being overused and they were having effects that no one anticipated. And they were not just things that poisoned insects. They were poisons. They poisoned pretty much everything that had the same kind of cell structure, which is pretty much all animals. And she pointed that out, and that had not occurred to, you know, the public. She used a lot of material that was science research that was coming out at that time, and she put that all together and synthesized it. So she didn't do that original research, and she didn't make this up. She looked in the science journals for all the new findings that were coming out about the unanticipated effect of these things that most people thought it was supposed to kill bugs. That's what it would do. Everything else that people had invented did what they said it would do. And this was something very, very different. And, the whole combination of who she was, how she was, when she was, and what she had, what she had sort of been tasked with by people who were saying, this is happening, we need someone to write about this. That is all what went into making her the right person at the right time.
And she stood her ground, and she was attacked. And in fact, really, in some ways, the attack on Rachel Carson by the military-industrial complex, I think we could call it, the chemical industry, even predated the defense of the tobacco industry.
That's true.
Yeah, and this, this is now well documented that these same techniques, these doubt-sowing techniques, these well-funded think tanks and so forth, this is the same thing that went into the climate change denial industry, which is now collapsing, yeah, of not passing any red face tests anymore.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Carl Safina. It's very, very well thought out, as always. It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about 50 years since Silent Spring, and I'm going to Alaskanize it a bit right now with Pam Miller, Executive Director of the Alaska Community Action on Toxics. Welcome to the show, Pam.
Thank you, Steve.
Your organization has been around for how long now?
About 14 years now.
And one would have to say, you need to talk into the microphone there. Yeah, it'll block your view of me, but it's better. I would have to say you were very directly carrying on the Rachel Carson legacy.
I'd say our work is inspired every day by the work of Rachel Carson, and I ask myself almost every day what work is left undone that Rachel Carson alerted us to, and how can we try to fill that gap?
Well, and I guess, she was talking about some chemical effects of DDT, but then we increasingly learned that chemicals and cancer are related. She died of cancer. And now we're another step beyond that, maybe several steps, in terms of what we know about chemicals, manufactured substances entering into the environment and not disappearing.
Yes. And I think Rachel Carson's work was so prophetic and so prescient. And she actually was one of the first to note the presence of DDT in the Arctic, and noted in Silent Spring that DDT was being detected in snowy owls in the Arctic, and that this was a real sense of foreboding. And I think that's something that our work is focused on, that these chemicals do not respect political boundaries. They may be sprayed on the fields of the southern United States or Mexico, but within 5 to 7 days, they arise on wind and ocean currents and end up in the Arctic and accumulate in the bodies of wildlife and people living in the north.
And hence, you've kind of become active on the POPs Treaty and beyond.
Yes, we have.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, the Stockholm Convention on Persistent Pollutants was an effort, a really global effort of more than 100 nations that came together to negotiate a treaty that would address some of the world's most toxic chemicals, including DDT and some of the other pesticides that Rachel Carson spoke of, such as chlordane, lindane, toxaphene, Myrex. And these are chemicals that are transported globally. They are a global threat to health and the environment. They end up in the Arctic. And the 100 Nations came together because it was noted in some scientific research that was done in Canada that Inuit women living in Canada had the highest levels of some of these chemicals in their breast milk. And everyone was shocked when that finding came out. And it really prompted the nations to come together to negotiate this treaty. And the real beauty of the treaty is that new chemicals can be added. It's precautionary in nature. It has the capability for those of us who can bring the science to the table to show that these chemicals have global influence to add new chemicals.
So you have to roll your sleeves up and keep documenting to make the case for other chemicals. Meanwhile, is it not so, Pam, that DDT and some of these other things continue to be used in tropical countries and a number of other places? And in fact, there are public health people that still say, I'm sorry, benefits outweigh the risks.
Yes, it is used for malarial control primarily in Africa, and I'm happy to say there are a range of alternatives that are coming online that I think will preclude the need for the use of DDT in the future.
Really? But meanwhile, there are new things of fire retardants and other things that aren't covered by the treaty.
Well, the treaty does include industrial chemicals as well as chemicals known as pesticides. So there are flame retardants that are included under the treaty, and we are proposing the addition of such chemicals as perfluorinated chemicals, which are used in stain-resistant pans and fabrics that are also found in the Arctic quite ubiquitously.
How did they get here?
Well, they arise on wind and ocean currents. They're volatile, so they become gases and move in the atmosphere into the Arctic. And once they hit a cold air mass, they settle out, and they might rest for a while on the surface of the Earth. And then as the Earth warms up again, they move up into the atmosphere and just steadily move northward and northward. When they get to the Arctic is just an environment that allows for the accumulation of these chemicals in the fatty tissues where these chemicals love to accumulate, and they have no place to go once they arrive in the Arctic.
How much monitoring do we have?
Well, very little in Alaska. Canada has a very good monitoring program. Alaska really has a lot of work yet to be done on really assessing.
We never have any money. We can never That's afford right. anything like that. We always want the feds to do it.
That's right.
Hmm. So that's where we sit.
But I did want to say,
what does the Canada data say before you get there?
Sure. Well, that the indigenous people of the Arctic have some of the highest levels of these chemicals of any population on Earth. And that, to me, is one of the greatest injustices of all.
Hmm. What about mercury?
Yes, mercury is also a problem from coal-fired power plants in Asia, the United States, and other industrialized countries, and it's rising at alarming levels in Arctic wildlife as well as people.
Is that another situation where it precipitates out because it's cooler in the Arctic?
Yes.
Hmm. Steve from Willow, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hello, Steve. Thanks for having me on the air.
Yes. Well, what do you say, Steve?
Well, I'm glad to be on the air. I wanted to speak a little bit about a pollutant that I think many Alaskans may not have on their site, and that's dog feces. And when I read Chapter 9, Rivers of Death, and I see our low salmon returns, especially in the Willow area, we've had a really, really poor year this year on the fish. And I've done some research, and it turns out that a modest-sized kennel of only 20 dogs can produce up to 2 tons of feces per year. And I just, as I do an overlay on the whole state, and I look at there could be as much as 100,000 dogs up here, and there's little or no regulation in the sled dog industry, I just wanted to bring up discussion that, you know, we could be looking at as much as 20 tons of feces being dumped into our pristine salmon watershed, And I was just wondering, you know, this might be the next DDT or the next pollutant we have to deal with.
Well, from runoff for sure. Steve, thanks for that from Willow. Where I know,
you're welcome.
Where I know there's quite a few dogs in your neighborhood.
There are, and you know, we came into this discussion when we were looking at some of the subdivision rules up here, and we found out there's absolutely no laws regarding, you know, open pit sites and location of water wells. We found that we could have a kennel next to us, and our well's only 50 feet away, and they could be dumping 2 tons a year. And, you know, there's no regulation right now. The EPA has it on their radar, but as far as the state of Alaska, you know, there's very little discussion.
All right, Steve, thanks a lot. Let's.
You're welcome.
I am. I'm thinking this runoff for the National Ocean Commission brought this up, and I think it's well known to just about anybody in the environmental field that when you have paving. And certainly anything with sewage changes, Carl Safina, changes the oxygen situation, oxygen demand and so forth in the waters.
Yes, it certainly can. And, the category of pollutant that falls into is what we would call nutrients, which is a nice word, but the dose is the dose is always what makes the poison. So, food is a nutrient, and at a certain level, food is absolutely crucial for life, and at a much higher level, food can greatly shorten your life. It depends how much of it you have. And that's the same with things like sewage, dog feces, or fertilizer. In a lot of the country, fertilizer running off of lawns and farms is one of the main sources of pollution, even though in a lot of the ocean, nutrients are a limiting factor, and there are there are very few things that can survive in the open ocean because there's not enough nutrients there for them. But you can overwhelm some places. You can overwhelm rivers and wind up killing almost everything that you're really interested in having there by having too much of a good thing, if one can call dog feces a good thing.
We're talking about 50 years since Silent Spring, and we've moved all the way from DDT to dog doo-doo. It's amazing. Love doing this show. Robert joins the program from Esther. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Robert.
Well, thanks, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. I was really surprised to hear the topic today. Rachel Carson happened to be my guru, if you will, back in the days when I went to Berkeley in the 60s. And she wrote, there's so many things in that book that ended up actually motivating me and to go into medicine, if you will. I was a biology major and actually was studying the pelican decline in California due to the connection back then. They were just starting to put it together that DDT in particular was softening the enzyme that hardens the eggs, and literally the pelicans were smashing their eggs in incubation, and this was pretty much real similar to the California condor, and I believe was linked to the eagles as well. But what I got out of Rachel Carson's book was basically DDT was just the tip of the iceberg. I think she pointed out that all you had to do is just change a little one molecule, and you had a whole new pesticide, and there were thousands of them. So when one was banned, different chemical companies would just go back to their labs and basically design a new legal chemical to be used. And, of course, the federal government was about 20 steps behind as usual. And so when they finally caught up, a lot of these chemicals were banned. Well, they just got shipped to other countries. And with the fact that we are importing so much of our food these days from other countries, and the FDA seems to be just really behind the ball about inspecting our food supply in this country from within, let alone without.
Well, as near as I can tell, the FDA is almost corrupt at this point.
Right.
And I mean, so, I just have to say it. I mean, it's pretty, just an observation.
Well, one of the reasons I got into medicine back in those days was the link between a lot of these pesticides and cancer. And, of course, as an undergraduate, I just kind of saw the world as a very black and white in those days, and it was kind of, well, if you put plastic cells in, you're going to get plastic cells out. And basically, there's hundreds of different pesticides that have been proven to cause, and low doses, I'm not talking about eating, you know, salmon every day, 24 hours a day, to get polluted by all kinds of things besides mercury. And so you're trying to tie this to Alaska is very timely with a lot of the industrial movements here in mining and fishing and whatnot, and how it affects all of us. And, you know, I think there's an illusion by Alaskans. I've lived here for 42 years, and I still think that, oh, geez, you know, none of this is really happening here. Well, when you take tests of the fats of sea mammals and whatnot and see the level of mercury's out up in the North Slope.
Oh, yeah, and you can't eat whatnot. You can't eat the livers, yeah.
No, you know, and yeah. So it's kind of like this isn't coming from here. We're not a big agricultural state. You know, it's a worldwide situation, but somehow or another we have this illusion that we aren't playing a part of this somehow or another. And so I just, you know, I thought it was a very timely topic. And with a lot of the proposals, and that's another program, unfortunately, the politics of it has gotten to the point where it's so polarized and so political that the science is being used as some kind of a currency or something, you know. And I mean, there are still people, some of them relatives of mine in the lower 48, that absolutely don't think that global warming is really happening, that it's a conspiracy, you know. And, you know, when you live here 42 years and you see it happening before your eyes, it's like, hey, you know, I don't watch or listen to some of the talk radio stuff about all this stuff, but I see it myself. And with the fishing, I'm seeing that myself too, from spending the last 3 or 4 years out in Prince William Sound, where some of the effects of chemicals will never be totally fixed in Prince William Sound ever.
Boy, you're not the first person that's brought that up to me, Robert. Yeah.
But you know, the media puts spins on all this, and politicians get elected either agreeing or disagreeing with some of these things that are happening. But I'm really glad you brought this up. You're the first person I've heard bring up Rachel Carson in all the years I've lived here as far as how it would be applied to what's going on in Alaska, and I applaud you for that.
Yeah, well, I'm very fascinated with how her message caught on, and trying to figure out what it was about the message that made it catch on so well. And Carl Safina has suggested that it had something to do with the shock of the new. I'm kind of holding out for the idea that there was there's a notion of sympathy and compassion that she was able to show us how we were related to all these other species, that we're all in the same world together. And nowadays, you know, it all comes together in the Arctic, you like it or not. Pam Miller of Alaska Community Action on Toxics, you have got in front of you an ancient copy of a Rachel Carson book, an old paperback. What book is that?
Well, I brought along a number of her books, but the oldest one that I have here is Under the Sea Wind. And then I also brought Edge of the Sea Around Us, The Sense of Wonder, which was written to inspire parents to take their children out in nature and share the sense of wonder with children. And I also brought a copy of Silent Spring. But all of these books, I was just gonna add to the conversation that the research that Rachel Carson did in Silent Spring was phenomenal. And a number of scientists did come to her with information that was not publicized widely, if at all. The public just didn't know about it. And so Rachel Carson became the receiver of all this information. And I also think the beauty of her language was also quite phenomenal and helped inspire a number of scientists and naturalists and other people to come forward. And
so it's not just what was said, it was the way.
The beauty of her language, yeah. I mean, she was concerned about silence, and she was concerned about the hushed complicity of scientists in league with the chemical corporations. She was concerned about the silence of a spring without birdsong. She, as Carl mentioned, hadn't wanted to write Silent Spring, but she felt compelled to do so when a friend wrote to her about the suffering of birds on her lawn after exposure to pesticides. And she wrote, "The other day I saw a wonderful quote from Abraham Lincoln. I told you once that if I kept silent, I could never again listen to a Veery's song without overwhelming self-reproach. The quote is, to sin by silence when they should protest makes cowards out of men." And I think, you know, that really holds true today.
Thank you, Pam Miller, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Ensuring our youth understand the need for workplace safety will help prevent injuries. If your middle or high school is interested in having a youth representative speak to your students about workplace safety, call Alaska Occupational Safety and Health Youth Safety at 1-800-656-4972. This message is sponsored by Alaska Labor Standards and Safety.
Years since Silent Spring is the subject on Talk of Alaska. 50 years ago, Rachel Carson's book came out. It changed American attitudes toward the environment, towards toxic substances, and it could be argued towards our fellow creatures. With me is Pam Miller of Alaska Community Action on Toxics, and Carl Safina, author of The View from Lazy Point of the Blue Ocean Institute. And Carl, I was really excited to read in your book that you get even more cosmic than making Alaska the place where the circle is closed. You go way out in the universe and start talking about us as the stuff of stars. You know, maybe that is how the circle closes.
Well, everything is stardust after all, and we're part of everything.
Yeah, but it's fascinating to think of the planet as a density of star stuff, you know, that, you know, the atoms were made of had to come out of supernovas, or they wouldn't be big enough to make any kind of carbon-based life form. And to think of all that spectacular stuff going on in the universe and ending up in the wonderment of what people call creation. You say you're not exactly a religious man, but you believe that religion is an important part of what is in front of us. I wanted you to expand on that a bit.
Yeah, well, there are, you know, people think different things when they hear the word religion, and most people, when they hear the word religion, think God, but religions are not just their theologies. They're other things. They are the wisdom traditions. They are the social traditions. They are the moral and ethical imperatives that have come down through the sacred texts and over time. And they are a way of being devoted to an idea. And I think that our relationship to the natural world has to be religious in that way. We have to be devoted to our understanding of how humans relate to the world that we are in and to our responsibilities to the rest of the world and to one another, to the things that create the kind of world that's worth living in, or the things that will allow the world to perpetuate rather than running it down or robbing our children. In the Bible and in the Quran, both, it says that you can have wars. We kind of expect that people will go to war. But during war, even though you will kill each other, you may not destroy the fruit trees. And what is all of that about? You know, that is about we will have our conflicts now, but what is really the bigger sin is to rob the next generation of their options. And our relationship with the natural world is robbing the next generation of its options by taking away forests, taking away unpolluted fish, replacing them with polluted fish, taking away clean water, taking away species like the incredible destruction of elephants going on in Africa right now that is so absolutely horrifying. I can go on and on and on. We could spend many, many shows talking about all these kinds of things. But the point is that you can either shrug or you can say, I'm devoted to a different way of being and a different set of ideas and ideals. And then that becomes religious in that way without becoming theological. So religion means to be connected. It's the same root gives you the word for ligament, you know, the strands that connect your bones. And religion means to be connected with a purpose, and that's what we need to do. We need to be connected through a sense of purpose.
Very
religious in that way.
Very profound thought, Carl Safina. Pam Miller, I want to call on you, not so much to do theological speculation, but to talk about what our Esther caller brought up, which was that the chemical industry seemed to go beyond DDT to just change the molecule a little bit and keep selling it as something else. Is this still going on now? Is Roundup something that I should be afraid of?
I'd love to talk about Roundup.
I'll bet you do.
But yes, I think it's very concerning that we have now some 85,000 chemicals in commercial production. Very few of them have been tested for safety for human health.
So you don't disagree with me when I say FDA is corrupt?
No, I don't. Disagree. I think that's a very big concern. One of the concerns I have is the Food and Drug Administration allows the use of a very harmful chemical that Rachel Carson spoke of in Silent Spring called lindane, allows it to be used in shampoo treatments to treat head lice in children, even though the EPA banned it for all agricultural uses, and it's now banned globally, but our Food and Drug Administration allows it to be used as a pesticide on children. But I did want to say, and I agree with Carl, I think we do have a moral and ethical responsibility, and also to get back to what Robert from Esther said, there's an alarming increase in cancers, particularly childhood cancers. There's an epidemic of testicular cancer among young men. Breast cancer still is a huge concern. I just returned from a conference in Washington, D.C. on cancer and disease clusters, and there's increasing evidence linking exposures to some of these toxic and persistent chemicals to a range of diseases at exquisitely low concentrations. And I'd say since Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring, there's been a revolution in the science of our understanding about how these chemicals can affect our health at very low levels. They can affect our endocrine system at extremely low levels. They are linked with a number of cancers. They can cause thyroid disease, learning and developmental disabilities, birth defects, a range of effects that Rachel Carson was just beginning to understand when she wrote Silent Spring. And the real sad thing is, and this is why to me it's a human rights issue, is that much of this is preventable because we have safe alternatives. And Rachel Carson spoke about the road not taken, that we have many safe alternatives that we could employ rather than using this arsenal of toxic chemicals. And you mentioned Roundup, which is one of the most widely used herbicides in the country. And if you go down to Alaska Mill and Feed or some of these big box stores, it's all over the place, as are a number, hundreds of different chemicals that are available for use. And a lot of us would assume that if it's on a shelf in a hardware store, that it's safe and that we might go and apply it on our lawn safely. However, Roundup is now increasingly known to be linked with a range of adverse health effects, including non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a type of cancer. It's linked with birth defects and a whole range of health effects. So it's certainly not safe. And for example, I'll mention, and I think we'll have some callers from Talkeetna perhaps who will talk about this as well, the Department of Environmental Conservation has just released draft regulations that would limit the public's right to participate in decisions about the use of pesticides.
What?
And one DEC employee was quoted as saying that, in fact, if EPA approves these, that it means they're safe, so that the public really shouldn't have a right to participate in decisions about pesticide spraying, for example, concerning the Alaska Railroad.
Oh, yeah.
This is really, I think, a threat to our democracy here in Alaska.
Funny you should bring up Talkeetna, because Becky joins the program from there. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Becky.
Hi, good to hear you guys talk about this. Pam is absolutely right, and I believe that Rachel Carson would have been really proud of the Alaska public and the political administration that prevented the use of herbicides and pesticides on state public lands for over 26 years. But that situation, you know, has been deteriorating. The Parnell administration, let the railroad start spraying in 2010, and now the right-of-ways on the highways are starting to be sprayed. Richardson Highway, Seward Highway, Dalton and Elliott. So the situation is really deteriorating to where herbicide use is going to become more of a way of life on our state public lands, and the pesticide rule change that DEC has come out with is just a slap in the face. I mean, it totally eliminates the public process. And the public comment for these rule changes came out during the summer, during the busiest time of year. And so many members of the public, about six state legislators, non-governmental groups, you know, asked them to extend the comment period because this is radically going to change the way the state does business with pesticides, and they refused. So, And the problem is politically is that you don't see the effects of pesticides and herbicides until years down in the road, and it's just really hard, you know, it's a hard political thing to work on.
Yeah. So the status right now, Pam Miller, is that at what stage is this regulation?
Well, the public comment period closed in the summer, as Becky mentioned, and so we're waiting to see what the Department of Environmental Conservation and the Parnell administration come out with. But I think it is a slap in the face, and it is a threat to our democracy.
Well, would it be actionable on due process? I mean, this seems pretty...
Yes, it would effectively eliminate the public's right to
comment.
Well,
what I'm saying is, couldn't somebody sue? I mean, this seems a little out of order.
Yes, and I think they should expect that.
Hmm.
But I wanted to get back to the Department of Environmental Conservation. The spokesperson was quoted in an Anchorage Press article saying, essentially, I want people to focus on the fact that these pesticides go through a rigorous EPA process. And I think the facts just don't support that. And in fact, there was a report of the President's Cancer Panel that showed that registered pesticides contain nearly 900 active ingredients. Most of them, many of them, are toxic, and they're not tested. They're simply not tested before they're put on the market.
Yeah, I think you know what you're talking about. Carl Safina, do you think, does it strike you that Pam knows what she's talking about here?
Yes, it certainly does. And I have complete confidence in everything that she is so eloquently stating, because I also know that it's true.
And so the fact that EPA hasn't gotten around to doing something about it doesn't mean that it's safe. Or that the FDA has not gotten around to do something about it doesn't mean that it's safe.
Well, I think that's the biggest problem, is that there are a lot of things that are out there that they haven't really gotten around to checking into. And the other thing is that what chemicals do out in nature is different than what they do in laboratories. And that's a double-edged sword. Sometimes they may seem more toxic in laboratories because the concentrations may be higher than what's found in nature. But for other things, the negative effects accrue over a long-term buildup that you can't really just study in a laboratory under, you know, the usual time frames of grant monies and
yeah, that's
people's careers and the need to publish and all of that kind of stuff. So you can't really study these chemicals very well before you see what they really do in nature, and you can't know what they're going to do in nature until you see how they're used. If something, let's just say something in a laboratory shows a low level of toxicity, and you use a little bit of that, okay, fine, no problem. But if it shows a low level of toxicity and you use an awful lot of it for a long period of time, or you use an awful lot of it in one region, you can have enormous problems that you can't really get to by just saying, oh, we tested it, or it wasn't tested, or we tested it in a laboratory under these conditions. It's a hugely imperfect process, and the main problem is that there's not a good reason for anybody to have any faith in any of it. It gets to be rather chaotic and rather confusing, and the best policy, in my opinion, would be to be exceptionally cautious about using any of these things, to use them only for very pinpoint and temporary applications. I think that for certain things, you might want to use, let's just say, and I'm not even committed to agreeing with the following statement, but you might want to use DDT inside a house if malaria is a problem in that household. It would be better to use bed nets. That would be the best thing. But DDT on the walls of a house is different than DDT on farms every day or every season at high levels. So it's always true that the dose makes the poison. And these discussions get completely away from asking the right questions or using the information in the right way, because sometimes something may be a little toxic, and then the use of it just goes way overboard. And one thing that Rachel Carson herself kept trying to emphasize was that it's not just that the chemicals are bad. It's that chemicals that are potentially dangerous are being overused and being used in places where their use is not really appropriate. And that part is the part that worries me the most, because it's still quite true. And the kinds of chemicals we have now are much more diverse than in her day 50 years ago. And the situation is much much more chaotic, I think. But when you see these cancer patterns and these cancer clusters, and if people get cancer at a different rate in different places, and that rate is the same over time, then you know that it's something in the environment that the people there are exposed to that's actually giving them the cancer. If suddenly lots more people in a different age group or in a different gender group start coming down with diseases that they did not have 10 or 15 years ago, then obviously there's something in the environment that's happening that's new, that was not well enough checked out in some study in a laboratory. So I think we have proof that the process doesn't work to protect us.
50 years since Silent Spring is a subject as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Providence Imaging Center, with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology. PROVImaging.com. The Federal Aviation Administration, setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704. And by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com.
Well, it's all about good radio. Talk of Alaska, subject 50 years since Silent Spring. This from Bob by email. It's always fun listening to Heimel get all esoteric about national or international issues while ignoring the problems right under his Alaskan nose, i.e. only 40 minutes into the program, you finally get to Alaska Railroad pesticide use. Yeah, but you listened, didn't you, Bob? Chris joins the program from Eagle River. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Chris.
Thank you. You've been talking about the link of environmental triggers to cancer. I would like to hear your guest views on the possible connection to the increase worldwide of autism.
Oh, boy. I think Pam Miller can handle that a bit.
Well, I'll give it a try, Chris, and thank you for raising that issue. I think there's a lot of new evidence linking chemicals such as pesticides to a range of learning and developmental disabilities, and also increasing evidence concerning the link between certain chemicals and the onset of autism. And I think it's a whole new area of science. I think the rate of autism is rapidly increasing. I think it's now 1 in 100 children have been diagnosed with autism, and it's more than just a matter of diagnosis, but I think this really reflects an alarming rate in the increase of autism. So again, I think as with cancer, we can prevent autism and a number of learning and developmental disabilities by simply reducing and eliminating a child's exposure to harmful chemicals. And that's, I think, what our obligation is. And I think another great concern that I have is that these chemicals have multi-generational effects. They're passed from one generation to the next, from the mother to the child in blood, across the placenta, through breast milk. And I think it's our obligation to future generations to protect children from exposure to these chemicals, not just pesticides, but flame retardants and other chemicals that can be passed from mother to child, sometimes 2 or 3 generations.
I'm wondering what you think of the public health people. I have problems with them because they tend to balance. They always have to balance. They have to live in a practical world of what people are really going to do and how they're going to react. They don't like panic, and they don't like people judging their own risks, it seems. They're afraid they won't. And so they sometimes give advice that just might not be, people might want to take more responsibility than the public health people want them to have.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, Steve. I think the public health community is really set up to address infectious disease, and they're not so well informed, I think, about environmental health implications of chemicals. And I think there's a lot of denial around this, and a lot of denial about the revolution in science that's talking about the long-term and multi-generational effects, epigenetic effects, endocrine effects.
You don't get too much of that in public health school.
No, very little. Yeah. In fact, the medical community, physicians and nurses also receive very little of that in their education.
Interesting. Chris, did that help you out?
Yes, thank you.
All right, thanks for your call. Bob joins the program from Thorne Bay. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Good to hear from Thorne Bay.
Thanks, Steve, for taking my call. I read Rachel Carson when I was in high school. I read her 2 or 3 times over 2 years, and to me, she pretty much pointed out the obvious, if we are willing to look at it, and that we all have consequences. And the more convenience we want, the more consequences we have. And that's kind of what I got out of it. And I ended up having a job directly because of her. I helped get a large industrial complex in Southeast in compliance with the Water Pollution Act of 72. So she's had an impact on my life, whether I knew it was going to happen or not. If I could address one other subject, I personally believe that aspartame is one of the causes of juvenile diabetes, and I'd like your panel to address that if they would. And if I could leave one comment on the way out, I'm against Pebble Mine. It's a bad spot, and it's a bad time, and it shouldn't be there. All righty. Thank you, sir.
All right, Bob. Comments on aspartame. Carl Safina, you got one?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I don't know enough about it to comment, but I do know that Pebble Mine is a nightmare. I can say that from 3,000 miles away.
Pam Miller?
I would certainly agree with that. And just briefly about aspartame, I think it's linked with also a whole range of neurological problems, and it's something that we should avoid.
All right. Well, I want to take it back a ways to Alaska, if I can, And it seems to me that one of the things that you write about in your book, Carl Safina, The View from Lazy Point, is restoration, that you've actually seen some restoration. I know I was amazed. I'd never seen a bald eagle in my life, and they're back in my hometown area now. And that's because of Rachel Carson.
Yeah, very directly. The worst, most obvious bird declines were the birds of prey. Also pelicans, it's true, but birds of prey, like especially bald eagles, ospreys, and peregrine falcons, they had been erased from most of the lower 48 states. When I was a teenager, I went fishing every weekend for 6 months of the year, and the first osprey I saw was in the early 1970s, but the second osprey I saw was not until 6 years after that. Not long ago, I went to the same place where I saw the first osprey, and instead of seeing 2 in 6 years, I saw 6 in 2 hours. That's the kind of recovery and resilience that nature is capable of. Bald eagles also really, really repopulating and doing very well in a lot of the lower 48. And peregrine falcons, same thing. I used to be involved in a monitoring program where we were counting the numbers of peregrine falcons coming along the beach in the mid-Atlantic states on the ocean beaches. The first year I did that for a month, and I saw 6 in a month. And the last year I did it, you could sometimes see 20 or 30 or 40 in a day.
All right, thanks. So and then we didn't even get we didn't even get into the coral reefs coming back faster than people expected. Well, the last word goes to you, to Pam Miller. Do you think we're going to see a time when restoration in Alaska is something that the rest of the world can learn from?
I think those kind of stories are really heartening, and yet we have to remember that even though DDT was banned in most places more than 30 years ago, the concentrations are still rising in the Arctic and still affecting the ability of birds of prey, such as the peregrine falcon, to reproduce. And so we have a lot of work ahead of us, and I think, you know, we need to remember that there's a lot undone that Rachel Carson began, and she invoked a sense of wonder, and she also spoke of our human rights to live in a healthy environment. I think that's her legacy.
All right. Thank you, Carl Safina. You'll be happy to know that we got task forces looking at our salmon situation now since you were on the
Good.
Show last.
Great to know.
Thank you so much for joining with us, and we'll look forward to your upcoming public television series.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. The Project Management Institute will present 3 one-day seminars at the Petroleum Club of Anchorage, October 9th, 10th, and 11th. Expert Neil Whitten will present No-Nonsense Advice for Successful Projects, Let's Talk, More No-Nonsense Advice for Project Success, and The Gift of Wisdom, Work-Life Balance for Today's Managers, Learn to Manage Projects, and more. Registration information at pmiak.org. This message sponsored by Project Management Institute, Alaska Chapter. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.